All right, good morning, everybody. This is Tuesday, March 27th, the morning work session of the Portland City Council. Today, we're going to start off with the revenue special topic, which sounds very, very exciting. We have Jennifer Cooperman here today to kick us off. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. Green is on, right?
Yes. Green is on.
Thank you. So thank you for inviting us. I'm Jennifer Cooperman, Chief Financial Officer for the City of Portland and Director of the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services. We are here to talk about to have a discussion regarding the enterprise-wide goal of stable revenue generation and looking at cost-saving efficiencies to collect on these revenues. And how do we get to the... You'll put up the presentation. Me?
I know.
Sure. Yes. Getting there. Great. Thank you.
This is okay. When we find out who the diehard people are, Rob.
So in our agenda today, we will be covering four topics, the first of which is collecting money that is owed to the city. Some people refer to this as collecting the low-hanging fruit. Then looking at efficiencies in the actual collection process itself so that we are spending the least amount to collect the most. Looking at cost recovery approaches to cover the collection costs. And then potentially looking at new revenue streams. Good morning. So this is the first of a couple slides covering the collecting monies that are owed to the city. We have several categories, and they're not in any particular order, so I'll just clarify that up front. The first is taxes. The city collects a number of taxes. The revenue division is point for collecting those taxes, and when we look at how we manage our operations for collections, we do a return on investment analysis when we ask for new staff. This year in the budget process, we have requested an ad package for additional frontline collection staff and revenue and support a team in city attorney's office, a paralegal and a legal assistant to assist revenue with collecting our taxes that are owed to the city. We also have liens and foreclosures liens where property owners owe money to the city. We have a process now in place where we take them through to foreclosure if those liens do not get paid. There is an ad package this year, or at least a discussion between city attorney with the Bureau of Development Services for an IA to provide support for the foreclosure process. Some other categories.
Jennifer, could I ask you a question, please? So on the taxes, the return on investment analysis. So will that be provided with any ad package that's requested this year for additional tax collection capacity?
Yes.
Yes,
it fantastic.
And it was provided. That was a question that the budget office asked us to provide, and we did provide that to them as part of the ask.
Excellent. I appreciate that. Thank
sure.
you.
Sure. Yes. Great. Getting the technology down. So accounts receivable is another section to talk about. These are monies that are owed to the city in the normal course of our business. We do have a comprehensive financial management policy, FIN 6.04, which is called accounts receivable. It was last revised in 2006. So I will volunteer that this is time to take a look at it. It was actually written in pre-SAP days. It still references IBIS, which is the system we used before moving to SAP. So I would like to volunteer that I will spearhead a group to take a look at updating that policy. That policy is intended to provide bureaus with guidance on how to approach their accounts receivable, particularly what to do with receivables that are in the 90-day plus category. There is a question in my mind about whether our management of accounts receivable is being consistently managed, equitably managed throughout the city, so that a customer who has a receivable in one bureau, I can't tell you if their messaging is the same as they might be if they are a customer of a second bureau, but that is something that I would like us to be looking at. Related to that is our use of collection agencies. We do have a contract with a third-party collection agency, at least one contract.
One. I'm sorry, there's two. There's a subcontract.
Two. Sorry, I'm being corrected. There are two contracts. And a question in my mind again about whether or not we are being consistent in our use of that collection agency throughout the city, and that is something that we will be taking a look at.
In round numbers, how much are we talking about in terms of accounts receivable?
For accounts receivable or for the collection agencies?
Accounts receivable.
In our, happen to have the CAFR, our consolidated a comprehensive financial statement from June 30th of 2017. There is a number for the city's receivables, but what I would caution you is that it is not broken out in buckets by time frame. So it's not necessarily the case that these are delinquent numbers, but in our receivable number as of the end of June of 2017, actually, this is doubtful accounts. I'm sorry. Do you have the receivable number?
Well, first of all, there's no centralized place for this. Thomas Lynn, I'm the Revenue Division Director, and so that's why you have to actually go to different systems. The CAFR is going to show basically business-like activities and general fund debt. And so I don't have a clean answer for you today, but I can get that to you. For example, some of the debt that's on the ledger is related to the Portland Housing Bureau, and we know that much of that debt is non-performing, so rolling it up into a larger number about the overall AR for the city of Portland is can be problematic.
Round number, I mean, we're talking about thousands or millions?
We're talking millions.
Hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions. But again, not all of this is in the delinquent category. So according to the end of June, the net receivables for the city citywide, it looks like $258 million. But much of that may be in the 0 to 30 bucket, and we offer our partners 30 days to pay. So I'd like to do some more due diligence in order to get back to you on that.
Yeah, I mean, part of that number, right, is about $85 million of current debt at the time for water and sewer. So there's, you know, when you write that number down for what's current versus what's 90-plus days, you get a different picture. So I think it's that really that 90-plus day picture that we're interested in.
Right.
And how much do you write off annually? Uncollectible.
It really depends on the bureau. It's in the CAFR. Right. We would have to dig into that for you.
I will tell you, I do not think that we are doing it consistently across the city. The comprehensive financial management policy that talks about accounts receivable references writing off amounts that are older than 1 year. I don't know whether we are actually doing that.
So, Jennifer, I would assume that as you do your analysis, both on accounts receivable and collection, to the degree that you find inconsistencies, are you going to write those inconsistencies? What are you going to do with
write
that
them,
insight?
Write them, R-I-G-H-T?
Yes,
as
correct.
As in correct them?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay,
that would
good.
Be the goal.
I just want to beat the auditor to the punch since she hasn't shown up here yet.
Yes.
I want to make sure we correct that.
Right.
Good.
And
thank you.
I think the first thing that we need to do is write the policy so that the bureaus have guidance about what they should be doing. I don't believe that a policy that's not been looked at since 2004 or 2006 is necessarily giving good guidance to the bureaus.
I would agree. Yeah, I would agree.
Right.
Good. Thank you for doing
sure.
that.
Waiting for the... Great. And then two other categories related that I would like to mention about collecting monies that are owed are grant reimbursement billings and disaster-related reimbursement billings. What is important to point out, particularly regarding FEMA, is that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management, requires the city to pony up a 25% match if we are looking for reimbursement from the federal government after a disaster. So to the extent that there is an ad package for that 25% match that we do not approve, then we are not able to collect the 75 cents that FEMA would be giving us back.
Jennifer, can I just ask a clarification on that, though? Yeah. The city needs to put up that 25% match. You mentioned if an ad package isn't approved, but another option for council would be to ask the Bureau to find that match out of existing services.
Yes.
Okay.
Because
we have had that in the past where bureaus have said, I have to get this funding in order to get FEMA funding, but there are other alternatives mm-hmm. that council has.
Yes.
Thanks.
So moving now to collection process efficiencies. The city has put in place several efficiencies to help reduce the cost of collecting our receivables. Over the last couple of years, Treasury instituted a new lockbox service with our bank. A lockbox service is where, rather than the checks being mailed to the city so that the city can handle them and process them and deposit them, the customer mails a coupon along with a check to a P.O. box. The bank is paid to go to the P.O. box four or five times a day, pick up all of the mail. They process that in their own secure facility, deposit the money on our behalf to our bank account, and then send an electronic transmission, which gets automatically uploaded into SAP and posts the payment. So we have instituted two lockboxes with the city, the first for the arts tax in 2016, which greatly reduced the amount of time to acknowledge arts tax payments and to get those monies into the bank. And the second was last year with our central accounts receivable area. At the time, that was in accounting but has since been moved over to revenue. Again, those payments are being processed centrally by the bank. And we are in discussions right now with the police alarms group to set up a separate lockbox for them as well, so that they are not spending a third of their day opening the mail and posting checks and taking them to the bank. One of the other efficiencies that we have instituted are all of the online payment pages that allow customers to more easily and faster make their payments to the city. As you may recall, in 2015, we spent that year becoming payment card industry compliant, and it was after we achieved PCI compliance at the end of 2015 that our use of online payment pages dramatically took off. We've got about 40 or 50 pages set up where customers can make online payments, and we continue to see interest from the bureaus in setting up that facility. So that is an efficiency. What all of these also do, in addition to bringing efficiencies, is that they improve our internal controls so that we have fewer employees who are actually handling money, and instead the payments are being electronically processed and being deposited directly in the bank. We are finding that the bureaus that are adopting these efficiencies are internally redeploying the savings that they get. So I'm not sure that you will be able to point to a particular FTE that can be saved for adopting these efficiencies, but where the bureaus are taking the staff time that was devoted to these activities and redeploying it to other activities. One of the other process efficiencies that we are aiming to employ is the integrated tax software project. This will be in our revenue division. Bless you. We are working on the RFP and anticipate issuing that in 2018. This is a system that will replace seven or so unconnected legacy systems that we have today to collect our taxes. There is one system today for business license tax. There is a second system for arts tax. There's a third system for transient lodging tax, et cetera. They are not connected. They are legacy systems that were internally developed many years ago, and they do not integrate well, or if at all, with the federal tax information system that we have been...
Dan has a question.
Yes.
My question is, are you running this new software program by the Technology Oversight Committee?
We had a meeting last 2 weeks ago with the Technology Executive Steering Committee, mm-hmm. and got guidance from them. I anticipate that we will be bringing this to the TOC so that they can opine about oversight.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
I second that, and I had a question with regard to the federal tax information. So we heard Robert McCullough, and I think you may have been in the room when he was testifying, and he made a pointed case that we needed to continue to purchase the federal tax information. Is this system in addition to that or separate from that? How does this work with that ask?
This system, the integrated tax software system, is separate from but will integrate with and use the information from the federal tax information system.
So we still need the tax information,
yes.
in order to make this system work. So this is really an efficiency play?
It isn't necessary to make it work necessarily. You could have an integrated tax software system without FTI, but it's a way to integrate FTI into our operations and make our operations that much more robust.
Okay, because part of his argument was we could do a better job of collecting business income taxes if we had access to that database.
Mm-hmm.
And so is this a system where the database and the business income tax payments coalesce? Is this the platform?
Yes, this is the platform for that to happen. Maybe you, Thomas, take a second and explain what happens today.
Sure. So what happens today, about 5 years ago, the IRS approved, actually it was 2012, the IRS approved the City of Portland to receive federal taxpayer information directly. There are a great number of physical and IT security requirements that come along with receiving that data. It took us a couple years to build that environment out. And we began receiving the data, storing the data, and using the data out of an application that's dedicated for that purpose only. So we have federal taxpayer information residing in one environment, highly secure, and then all of our business license tax information is sitting in a different environment. When we go live with the integrated tax system project in 2021, we don't have a timeline yet, all of that data will reside on one platform in a data warehouse so that we'll be able to more readily use it, integrate it. And right now, these two systems are not integrated in any way.
So in today's environment where we have this budget ask on the table for the tax information, are we able to determine what our collection rate is on
yes.
business income tax? And are we able to identify significant gaps in that data?
Yes, we are. It's an inefficient usage, but it's still efficient enough to generate a positive return on investment.
Okay. Do we have enough personnel to be able to do that in a timely and effective manner?
Within the integrated tax system, using the federal taxpayer information system, I think, yes, that we do.
Okay.
The overall problem in the revenue division and the reason that we have an ask for five FTEs is just the explosion in the number of accounts that we have to maintain. So we've got over 100,000 accounts. A few years ago, we had 70,000 accounts. And so there's been a very large increase in the number of accounts. That generates a lot of workload that's really more customer service related than collecting debt or following up in an audit environment. So what we need is additional positions to help absorb that customer service work so that we can return our collection staff back to their core duties of collection.
Could you just give me a common sense example when you say a customer service role? Could you just give me an example of what that might be?
Sure. It's an inbound phone call. It's entering tax returns. It's assisting taxpayers with questions about compliance. It's the phone calls that we get back when we send outbound mail. So, for example, late in the year after we've identified everyone that's filed or should have filed, there's usually about 20,000 accounts that we did not hear from. They had filed a tax return in a previous year but haven't filed in the current year. So that generates 20,000 letters, which generates 20,000 phone calls.
And, you know,
so there's that core work where there isn't necessarily a check attached still has to occur. A few years ago, we saw a dramatic increase in the number of accounts following our making legal Uber, Lyft, where 20,000 drivers went and got business license accounts. And what we did as an efficiency measure is we identified those accounts that we thought were Uber, Lyft drivers that really never completed the permitting process with PBOT. So they drew the initial business license, but it didn't actually carry through with the taxable business activity. So in that case, we made a decision internally to essentially batch exempt 20,000 accounts by way of being more efficient about how we manage these accounts. There's some risk to that because some of those accounts probably were performing, but we don't have perfect information. We had to make a business decision based on the workload. And so since that batch exemption, we've seen our accounts continue to skyrocket. So we're doing everything we can, Mayor, internally to try to be efficient and to focus our efforts where there's real recovery and real dollars. But that said, that customer service work continues, and it's just exploded in the last few years.
Thank you.
So moving on from efficiencies to cost recovery, the city has policies that attempt to balance cost recovery with the program, social purpose, mission, equity, and making sure that we are accessible to the constituents that we are serving. We do have another comprehensive financial management policy, 2.06, called revenue. That's the guiding policy that we use. That was last amended in 2014, and I will offer that working with the CBO, we will at least review that and see whether or not that needs any update. I'm not aware that it needs any update, but we should take a look at it and show that we are current with our review of that. What we try to do in cost recovery is balance the direction for cost recovery by implementing user fees for private use transactions. That's one of the approaches that we are seeing some of the bureaus take regarding their budget asks. We've seen that in PBOT, we've seen that in parks, and I will offer one that that I've not put on the table yet, but I think would be appropriate for the city to take a look at, having it in my area of focus. Today, or 2 weeks ago, you approved a contract with a bank to be our merchant bank to allow us to process credit cards. It's a $25 million contract for 5 years. Just about every part of the city uses credit cards to offer services to the public. We have the opportunity to look at imposing convenience fees for the use of credit cards. And that would be transferring the costs that are currently being absorbed by the city to the cardholder. We charge convenience fees in two locations today in the city. One is in revenue for a business license tax, so that individuals paying their business license tax by credit card will pay an additional 3% for the convenience of using that card. The second is with Parking Kitty, which is the phone app that PBOT uses so that people can use their phone to pay for their street parking. The consumer pays an additional 10 cents for the convenience on top of whatever the base parking charge is. The card brands are very strict about the use of convenience fees and surcharges, and so I've asked our partner bank to take a look at all of our business and come back to us with some guidance about where we could, if we wanted, to impose fees for the use of credit cards. One of the core features of this option is that there has to be available other options for the consumer. They have to be able to pay through other mechanisms, and the convenience fee is truly that, just a fee for the convenience of using the card. So it is meant to preserve the equity and the accessibility of the base service, but providing a way to recover the fees from consumers who want that convenience.
So I have a question related to that, which is, it makes me wonder if the other mechanisms through which someone might conceivably pay for the service other than a credit card are ones that have a greater cost for the city to absorb. Say if someone were paying with a cashier check and that had to be processed,
mm-hmm.
you would have to weigh
yes.
the driving of consumers to a more expensive process from the city against the amount that you're collecting from the...
Correct.
So I just want to raise that as a concern, that if you start charging people more to use a credit card and some of those consumers respond by saying, okay, I'll pay cash, then that means you're, as a city, you're spending more time processing cash, which is something that is less convenient for the city and incurs a higher cost.
Except if people switch to direct debit, which I don't think has any cost, right? And certainly, I mean, I would change my behavior because I get a cash back from my credit card for paying by credit card. I don't have to pay anything to pay by debit.
Right.
I don't get anything. So mm-hmm. I would change my behavior. Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, all of the features that are attached to the credit cards that we use, frequent flyer miles, cash back, et cetera, are borne by the merchant. We're paying for those features that the cardholders have. So I'm suggesting that there may be an opportunity to take a look at this and then have a policy discussion about what we want to do, whether we want to do something, what we can do. And part of that absolutely will be looking at what the alternative costs are. It's not free to process coin in the meters. There are people who have to go pick it up. There are people who have to count it. They have to bring it to the bank, et cetera. Every place that we do online, every place that we do offer consumers an opportunity to use a card, we also simultaneously offer them an ACH or an electronic option, which is, for all intent and purposes, free because Treasury absorbs those costs. They are extremely cheap. We're not forcing anybody to use cards. We're giving them the option to use cards. We should just recognize that there is a pretty substantial cost associated with that and that we are absorbing that cost today.
Does Parking Kitty take direct debit?
No, it's card-based. Right. So the alternative to using Parking Kitty is to park your car, get up and walk to the meter and put coins in the meter, or use a card at the meter. And using a card at the meter does not incur that additional 10-cent convenience fee because you're not using your phone, you're actually using the meter. But then we are paying merchant fees for that card transaction at the meter.
Yeah, it would be interesting. We will have some data on how many people are using Parking Kitty versus getting out of their car and using their card.
Right.
And then, again, if you have a choice, I don't think you can use your debit card at the meter. I think it's only credit cards.
No, you can use your debit card.
All
yeah,
right.
But it's processed
as credit.
Oh, why would
I? Because I'm getting my cash back on my credit card. You can't use cash anymore. Right. Right. No, that's problematic.
So these are all really teeny dollar amount impacts that we're talking about, but in terms of volume, the city processes nine or ten million card transactions a year related to our parking system. So it's the dollar impacts per transaction are really small, but it's the volume that is ramping up and causing us to spend a lot.
Jennifer, what is the total amount of transaction fees that we are absorbing?
I'd have to get back to you on that.
I'd be curious to know. And do other cities absorb the transaction fee?
It depends. And a lot of times it depends on the state. Certain states, like Missouri, have laws that prevent them from charging fees. We don't have a law like that in Oregon, but it does come down to the card brand rules about what can be charged when and where and what type of transaction. And that's the analysis that I want the bank to come back and tell us what we can do.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. So the last category that our agenda covers is potential new revenue streams. And you're familiar with many of the new taxes that we have established over the last few years. Marijuana tax, heavy vehicle use tax, gas tax, CEO compensation surtax, and the arts tax. Some of the alternatives we have would be to increase a rate of an existing tax. In terms of bringing in new revenue, this is the most cost-efficient way because the system is already in place to charge that tax, and an adjustment to the rate would increase the revenue from that stream. Another alternative would be to look at imposing new taxes, and some of the ones that I'm familiar with and have seen discussions about over the last many months include cell phone tax, food and beverage tax, and a soda tax. So just putting those on the table as giving you a sense of what we've done previously and what some of the options going forward for us might be, depending on your level of interest. Question?
Yeah, tell us more about a cell phone tax. Where is that used? How does it work? What does it generate?
So I can speak to that to a depth, and then after that I'll turn to other staff who know more. But the assessment really is on wireless activity, and you have to be careful about which activity the tax applies to. So we can't tax access to the Internet, but we can tax the telephonic usage piece of the bill. So we modeled the tax here, I think it was just last year, we did an update for one or more council offices, and we had a tax on wireless communications analysis that indicated about $7 to $8 million gross could be collected here in the city of Portland. As to other jurisdictions, I would need to call up some staff for that. I'm off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you. Shall I do that?
Yeah.
Yes. Can someone speak to that? Other jurisdictions have a cell phone tax?
Like Washington.
Washington State?
The state of Washington would be an example.
Okay.
Yeah.
State of Washington?
Yeah, statewide, we're the lowest tax, and Washington is the highest. Ours is about 1%, and theirs is about 18%, or maybe even more. We looked into this as from my office because I was very interested. One thing, there's a lot of equity considerations to this because I was thinking, well, you know, if you have a cheaper system, a cheaper phone, you're going to not pay as much tax if it's a percentage. But it turns out that low-income people are more likely to have cell phones as their only telephone service and more likely to use it for their sole source of internet access. So it actually doesn't, there's a lot to be considered before we move down that path.
Thomas, can I ask, and I just haven't, and you may not have this today, but in terms of the number of people with landlines versus cell phones, I remember 10 years ago we were sort of tracking this very steady decline in a utility license collections based
right.
on landlines going away. I assume that trend has continued. Do you have those numbers?
It has. I don't have the numbers. The cable utilization, a lot of people are cutting the cord on the cable too, do we?
We can get back. Yeah, it was just, it's been a long, long, steady decline, which actually has an impact on our general fund as,
right.
as that utility license tax continues to decline as people switch over to cell phones. So,
I may have my own sort of naive misconception about this, but my idea as a consumer of services is that usually when you put a tax in place, the tax is responsive to a service that's being offered. So for the utility access, the city has a role in permitting and all the other things associated with that, and that incurs a cost to the city that has to be borne. And whether or not the tax covers the cost and generates excess or not is a separate question. But in this case, for the cell phone tax, one would have to wonder what is it that the consumer is getting in response for paying this tax associated with this thing that they've been using in the past and not been taxed for, right? So, I mean, that's just beware of pushback from consumers.
So I don't disagree with that, except that the most I pay in taxes is to the federal government, and they use it for whatever they want. I mean, it has nothing to do with my income at all. But the other issue, and maybe this is really for the next session when we get to sustainability, is here we are again in a cut year. The reality is if we had the same budget cycle 10 years ago, we would have a surplus. And the reason we're talking about reductions, including closing community centers, is because we now have new responsibilities, including the $28 million in general fund that go towards the Joint Office of Homeless Services. So we've created entire new areas of demand for general fund resources because the people we work for expect us to address it, but there is no commensurate increase in revenues. So we have our finite revenue stream, but burgeoning demands on that revenue stream. And so we find ourselves in this constant environment where we're trying to figure out which of the services do our bosses want that we're going to have to cut. And so for me, the revenue, well, I agree with you, Rob, that you know, in a purist sense, you want a revenue to be directly related or at least have some at least tenuous relationship. I can't think of what it is you would quote tax or charge a fee to that actually addresses a humanitarian crisis and a livability issue. And so for me, I'm starting to move off of that dime a little bit and think about what does it actually take to create a sustainable, effective government that delivers the service the people who hire us say they want us to deliver.
I completely understand your perspective on that. I mean, we understand that there's a structural and systematic underfunding of road infrastructure, of parks maintenance and infrastructure. I mean, we you know, every year we have this conversation. And we know that with the crisis in people experiencing houselessness and the city's response to that, there's a serious issue there too. But I think to the extent that it's possible to put in places, and people are willing and have demonstrated that willingness to vote for gas taxes and vote for housing bonds and things like that. So I think to the extent that you can connect those dots, you're going to have a much more robust response from the Portland community. Portland residents care about that stuff, and I think they're willing to put their money where their values are.
So on that line, I think of these options, the food and beverage tax, the restaurant food and beverage tax is the one that is most optional and that people who have lower incomes don't have the access to. So to me, there's a connection between that. Excuse me. It also has the virtue that all those tourists coming in would be paying it, which would be good. I know when I go to Ashland to see plays, I pay their tax. We thought it went to education. It turns out it goes to sewers. At least most of it does. So it's, I feel a little less good about helping to pay for the residents of Ashland sewers, but I'm sure they put other resources elsewhere.
There's an important dynamic here, too, in Oregon, which is somewhat unique in terms of our property tax system and the limitations on that. So our property tax rate is defined in the Constitution and cannot change. So it grows only when we have development or, you know, property values grow, and there's a connection there, a very complicated, you know, issue. When I get together with finance, you know, officials in other states and other cities, the big question they have every year in their budget is, do we raise our property taxes this year, right? Do we raise our millage rates? And there's, you know, political issues around that, and there's, you know, some, and a lot of states have limitations of different sorts, but that's not even an option Portland has. So when the mayor talks about these new services, we don't get to come back as part of our process and say, are Portlanders willing to pay additional property taxes for providing homeless services, providing, you know, emergency management, et cetera, which is why I think we find ourselves going to some of these other, you know, sources of revenue, because that tool really, it was taken away from us 20 years ago.
And if I could go back to the idea of a rate increase of an existing tax, I'd like Thomas to speak about the business license tax and give you some context for how to think about that.
So the business license tax has been at 2.2% of net income with some deductions since the 1970s. Right now, if the council were to consider a rate increase, I can't think in my recent memory in 15 years with the division, I can't think of a better year. Simply because most businesses are looking at substantial federal tax relief in tax year 2018. If the council desired, you move the rate to, say, 2.3%, would yield an additional $4.5 million per year ongoing. If you move that rate to 2.4%, I think that's also a modest adjustment. Now you're looking at just this side of $9 million ongoing per year. So, coupling a modest increase with substantial federal relief, in addition to the fact that this is well-trodden ground for the city, wouldn't draw a lawsuit, certainly would draw some feedback from the business community, but in terms of its legality, in terms of the administration cost, in terms of there'd be no changes there whatsoever. It'd be very easy to implement something like that. So for your consideration.
Thomas, can you remind me where we are on the owner's compensation deduction?
It's right around 100,000. What's the current owner's comp? 103. It's grown a little bit.
That's certainly intriguing. So I just wanted to mention one more thing on the soda tax, which is that it's still early days yet, but it may be worth holding off a little bit and looking too hard into that with what's going on with IP 37. I mean, if they pass that, it's off the table.
So we've covered looking at our policies and process for collecting monies owed, and I'll be coming back to you with revisions to the policy regarding our accounts receivable and our use of collections. We've talked about collection process efficiencies and redeploying the efficiencies that we are able to gain internally within the bureaus. We will be looking at more lockbox operations, et cetera. I'm open to any ideas that people have about how to more efficiently collect the money that we are owed. We talked briefly about cost recovery, and I volunteered that I will be looking at our merchant fees and coming back to you with an analysis of what we may be able to do there for your consideration. And we covered new revenue streams, putting some thoughts in front of you about how to approach that. So that is the material that we prepared for you. You're welcome.
Rob?
I had one more sort of area that I wanted to ask about, which is, so my understanding is that the city is responsive to low-income homeowners who are having issues with permitting related to improvements that are required by code on their properties. And I was just wondering, for foreclosures and liens, what the standard operating procedure is for a low-income homeowner who's having trouble making their tax payments. Like, what are the general guidelines for how long someone can be in arrears before they're going to be foreclosed? If there are payment plans that can be put in place for low, because the last thing we want to do for someone of modest means who's having a hard time getting their tax bill paid is to throw them out of their house and then have to fund their housing through the Joint Office of Homeless Services. So I would love to hear what is being done in that area. Thanks.
So the City Code Section 5.30 discusses liens and assessments, and it is the city auditor's purview to, through the foreclosure manager, to work with property owners who have liens outstanding on their property. And the foreclosure manager works with them to set them up on payment plans. To the extent that they can come to an agreement about that, the homeowner is put on a payment plan. If they continue to be delinquent, there is also a collections committee that the city auditor is responsible for convening. I'd have to look at the code to tell you about the composition of that committee. But the committee looks at all of the interactions with the property owner to evaluate whether or not they've been given sufficient opportunity to develop a payment plan, adhere to the payment plan, and account for all of the issues impacting that homeowner. And the collections committee then gives their recommendation about moving a particular property to foreclosure or not. Then it's up to the city auditor to bring properties to council.
Thank you. I worry about this most when it comes to fixed income seniors and retirees. I mean, if property taxes, ostensibly they can cover them, but sometimes when I'm attending the town halls of our legislators, I hear low income seniors talk about property taxes as being something that's very difficult for them to handle.
And property taxes would be managed at the county level for delinquent property taxes. So far, the city's efforts regarding foreclosures have been targeted to vacant and abandoned properties.
Yeah, I was just going to add, the city council just foreclosed on three properties. It is a very rare circumstance that we actually get to foreclosure, and even when we get to foreclosure, there's still a year time period by which the owner can make payments or reach an agreement. Mm-hmm. And the ones that finally make their way to the council, I mean, out of the hundreds that are currently on the rolls, The three that made it to us have, I mean, they're barely standing at this point. They're clear community nuisance issues, and there have been innumerable efforts to work with the owners, which are often either banks or absentee owners, over a period of many, many years. I think one of the properties that we just foreclosed, it's been 18 years.
Right.
So this is not an aggressive aspect of our government. It is an extremely rare circumstance.
That's very reassuring. Thank you.
Yeah. This was ginned up 2 years ago after being dormant for 40-plus years. And of the 13 properties that the council has approved for foreclosure, they've all resolved before actually being sold at the foreclosure bid that I conducted in City Hall. The one property that actually went to the auction, there were no bids at the auction, but it within 30 days it resolved in a private sale. So it's been the threat of foreclosure that has made folks attend to the outstanding liens rather than the property actually being sold through foreclosure itself.
Thank you, Jennifer and Thomas. I appreciate it. So, colleagues, we could do one of two things. We could take a break now. My preference would be that we go forward with the innovative financial sustainability approaches and then take a longer break after. Would that?
I'd appreciate 5 minutes now.
Why don't we take 5 minutes now, and we'll come back and start in 5 minutes, and then we'll take a little bit of a longer break after this as well. Thank you. We are in recess.
Now we allow the 75%. It's generally happening. You know, it helps with administration. Some people not understanding and doing it wrong.
And we could model that, couldn't we?
We could probably model that.
Well, because it's on the report.
Let's go ahead and get going.
Interesting.
So we are at the Innovative Financial Sustainability Practices. This is a special topic that I asked for today because Portland's financial sustainability is one of the most significant issues that we face during this budget process. And as I noted last November, I'll be proposing a budget that addresses the urgent issues of today while also making long-term shifts that put Portland on what I hope will be a more sustainable financial path. Bureaus have been asked to focus on their core missions and either put up for or consider elimination of programs that are not consistent with their core programs or our programs that they cannot make a case should be moved to a different location. And second of all, obviously, as a council, we've talked about this. We need to be aware of the long-term impacts of the decisions that we make, whether we're creating new programs or addressing labor contracts or underinvesting in infrastructure. Each of the decisions impacts Portlanders over the long run, and we need to be cognizant of those impacts. So today I've asked CBO to come forward to all of us here and identify some potential strategies that will position the city for a more sustainable financial future. With that, Andrew, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you for that introduction. And, you know, I'm joined here by Jennifer Cooperman, the Chief Financial Officer, and Tom Reinhart, Chief Administrative Officer. And Cyril DeSummers-McGee, our HR Director, will be here. She had a conflict, so she'll be here at about 11 for her portion of the presentation. But, you know, it's reflective, I think, of the types of things we're going to be talking about today on this agenda across a lot of areas. And there are a lot of enterprise-wide solutions that we're putting on the table. And so it's been really kind of fun, frankly, over the last couple of weeks to begin to brainstorm on some of these and talk to my colleagues and really start thinking about what are the things that will help put us on that sustainable path. The agenda, and we'll go ahead and put the slide up, Sarah. The agenda today, we're going to spend just a little bit of time talking about cost drivers, but I'm not going to spend very long on that because we really want to move to some of these innovative solutions and innovative strategies for these key issues. And they really are in four different areas. We're going to talk about how we can manage our programmatic cost growth in the city a little bit differently. We're going to talk about infrastructure and major maintenance costs, and I know we've already done some presentations to council about that, but we've got some ideas that are really forward-looking in terms of how we can take the next step on infrastructure. We're going to talk a little bit about PERS, the liability there, and although it's a pretty intractable problem, there are some things we might be able to do in the future, and we also want to highlight what, you know, an impact it does have on our budget. And then finally, overall, managing personnel costs and some different things we might be able to do in that regard. So slide three, and I want to spend a few minutes on this because there's a lot of really interesting and I think useful information on this slide. So what we're trying to show here is over the last 4 years, so going back to the 2014-15 budget all the way up through the current fiscal year, 2017-18, what's happened in terms of our budget and where has the excess money, the surplus that we've experienced in this period of time gone? What you can see in that top line there is that the total additional investments over this period of time were $97.5 million. This represents a 5.9% average general fund discretionary growth over that four-year period. That is significantly higher than our historical, and you can see that the other dotted line there to the left. Our historical average growth, if you go back 15 years, so since about 2002, has been about 4.5%. And that's the average growth. So that does include the Great Recession, right, which obviously was very low growth and, in fact, a couple of years where our general fund discretionary fell in real terms. But you can see over the last 4 years how much better things have been, and that really is a pretty dramatic increase in our overall general fund. But what we've done below that is break out where those funds went. And I think in terms of things I want to highlight, one of the most important things that we don't talk a lot about, but maybe should talk a little bit more about, is how much inflation on our base budget eats up of our additional funding. So you can see there, in terms of personnel and external M&S, EM&S is external M&S. These are the goods and services that we as a city buy. So what we pay for our people and what we pay for our goods and services ate up about $46.6 million of that excess funding. you know, it makes sense. We expect inflation to grow between 2% and 4%, but this does limit, you know, council's ability to invest in other programs and other expenditures. So of that surplus, only about 40% has really been what council's had discretion on. And the other thing I would add there, in addition to that personnel, if you drop two lines down to PERS, we're also treating this as non-discretionary. This is a rate that we pay that the state, you know, gives us. And so adding those two things together, you know, about 60% of that excess has just gone automatically to those things, meaning that about 40% has been left over for other things. We've then broken out what those other items are. And you can see in terms of new adds and cuts, we've added about $15.5 million net. However, it's worth noting that we actually added about $40 million in new ongoing programs at the same time we've cut $24 million of programs over that four-year period of time. So again, this is when you hear from some of the bureaus who have testified and they've talked about some of those reductions. They really have felt those, right? $24 million of reductions over the last 4 years. On the other hand, we've made some very large new investments in other programs as well. And this gets what the mayor talked about, you know, in our last session about some of these new demands in the community and these new services that we're providing. Labor agreements that have been approved over the last few years are just under $9 million. And I want to stress that does include the PPA agreement, but this is the cost through 17-18, so it's actually not fully implemented yet. So if you remember with the PPA agreement, it was a few million dollars every year. And so we're in year two of that agreement, so those dollars will go up in the future as well. We included something there for backfilling previous reductions, just to separate that out. So there were some reductions that were taken by council in the spirit of time that were then